Blog Talk Radio.
Gigantic news day. I mean, so much to talk about. So many necessary stories to cover. Usually, there's like one big story that you have to cover, and then the rest is just basically a matter of choice. Today, the entire show is basically jam-packed full of just must-covers and super important stories. We, of course, have the disastrous attacks in Paris. And we also have the Democratic debate. So no time to fuck around. Let's jump right into it. We'll kick it off here with the... I got actually many segments. One, two, three, four... At least four segments. Kind of more like five segments on the terror attack. And then after that, we'll get to the Democratic debate. Hopefully I can squeeze it all in. Let's give it a shot. There was a gigantic terror attack in Paris, France on Friday night. Six different locations were attacked more or less simultaneously. At least 129 people are dead as of right now, although that number continues to change and grow because some people are injured and in the hospital. There are 352 people who were wounded. At least 99 of them seriously wounded, so again, the death toll of 129 can possibly go up at any second here. A concert hall was hit. At least two restaurants were hit. There were also suicide bombers and gunmen at different locations, part of three separate terror groups that are all part of the bigger group, of course, of ISIS. A soccer match where the French president was actually at was hit, and they had to, I guess the French equivalent of the Secret Service had to rush in, grab him, and rush him out. He's okay. Hollande is okay. Seven terrorists were allegedly killed. Of course, some of them, like I said, from blowing themselves up because there were some suicide bombers. Again, ISIS took responsibility for this. There's apparently one terrorist named Salah Abdeslam, who's still yet to be captured. Authorities actually briefly stopped him, but then let him go at the time because it was right after the attacks and he wasn't a suspect yet and there was zero evidence that he was one of the guys they were looking for. So at least as of right now when I'm coming on air, they haven't gotten him yet. Apparently he has brothers as well who were involved in this. CNN says the following, quote, 23 people are in custody, and weapons, including a rocket launcher and IT equipment, have been seized after more than 150 police anti-terror raids were carried out in cities across France since Friday, said French Interior Minister Bernard, I'm going to butcher this, Cazeneuve. My ignorant American side comes out, as always. And he ordered, it says, who has ordered 104 people to be put under house arrest. So they're doing these raids, and some people have been ordered under house arrest. Now, the government of Iraq is claiming that ISIS leaders planned the attack in Syria, and they ordered the attacks. And apparently there were warnings from the government in Iraq. Turkey also said that they warned France twice about the attack, and they also warned France about another guy who is allegedly the mastermind behind the attacks. Officials say Abdelhamid Abaoud may have been the mastermind behind it. Media in Belgium said Abaoud had been involved in a series of planned attacks in Belgium that were foiled by the police last January. He's a Belgian national who's now in Syria. Now, France has already retaliated. They dropped at least 20 bombs on the declared capital of the Islamic State, which is Raqqa in Syria. And Reuters is reporting that they hit the command center, recruitment center, munitions depot, and training camp. According to some activists on the ground there, no civilians have been killed, but also they say no ISIS members have been killed either. The Daily Beast is reporting that the terrorists were actually attempting to target apostates when they did what they did. They killed way more. I mean, they killed, again, well over 100 people. But they say that they were first and foremost targeting apostates, and one of them allegedly shouted, "This is for Syria." Now, you know, whenever you get one of these attacks, you always need, like, at least 5 days, a week, before you can really get more solid information, because the stories change so much in the initial chaos of the events here. But think about, assuming those things are true, the screaming, "This is for Syria," and the targeting apostates, let's take that at face value for now. Think about how stupid that is. So when they scream, "This is for Syria," well, guess what, jackasses? Apparently you haven't been following Syria very closely, because France is anti-Assad. They were anti-Assad, and they were supporting Syrian rebels who were trying to overthrow Assad. Now, I don't want to get too far off in the weeds here, but guys, the Syrian rebels at this point, it's basically ISIS and al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda offshoot in Syria, and some other Islamists and jihadists. The FSA, which were the moderate rebels, are basically non-existent now. There's a handful left, but most of them fled to Turkey and to Europe. So they're saying this is for Syria, but you didn't even realize that France was de facto on your side in Syria, because they are anti-Assad, in the same way that the U.S. and other Western countries are anti-Assad, because Assad is aligned with Putin, of course, and Iran. So even according to your own ideology, to say this is for Syria, that just doesn't make any sense, because apparently you didn't fucking research to realize that they're actually supporting the rebels who are trying to topple Assad. So that makes absolutely no sense. And don't even get me started on, oh, we're killing apostates. Somebody else said, well, they were also targeting music, because music is haram. So it's not allowed under fundamentalist Islam. So they're like, well, we got to kill the people who are listening to music. Look at these religious fundamentalist jackasses. All right. They don't have to live by the bullshit you live by. All right? So you have your own fairy tale interpretation of this. You believe in Narnia. You believe in the Tooth Fairy. But that doesn't mean that you get to take a gun and point it at other people if they don't agree with your horse shit. I mean, really, you're going to target apostates. And this also shows you, by the way, that it clearly is directly linked to the fundamentalist interpretation of Islam and a strict adherence to Sharia. So understand, whenever it's always complex and complicated as to what exactly leads to these circumstances, but without that deeply religious ideology in place, they wouldn't have been pushed over the edge to do what they're doing here. And remember, guys, it's them telling us that that's why they're doing it. It's not us, you know, putting it on them. I'm not reading into the situation. If you look at what they say, just look at the group that's claiming responsibility. They say, oh, yeah, we did a global caliphate. That's why we're doing it, global caliphate. For fuck's sake. All right, so the question then becomes, of course, what do we do in response to this? And when I say we, I mean it in a broad sense. What does the U.S. do in response to it? What does France do in response to it? What does the West in general do in response to this? Now, that's a very, very difficult question, but I'm going to do my best here to answer it and tell you what I think the policy moves from here forward should be. So first of all, the obvious, which is catch the culprits and the planners and bring them to justice. Okay. Now, again, as I said, France is already bombing Raqqa. I'm going to get to that in a second. But first and foremost, and they are on this, they're doing manhunts and everything and trying to gather as much information as possible. That one's easy, the one we all agree to. All right, catch the culprits, bring them to justice. Then the second thing is, and they're also doing this now, credit to them. I was kind of amazed that I saw the headlines about this, you know, within 48 hours of the terrorist attack, but you should do the long-term strategy of destroy the oil fields of ISIS and destroy the supply lines. No organization can function without a steady flow of cash. They're no different. They can't rise above that. They might believe in their fundamentalist religious ideology, but when push comes to shove, if you can't pay the guy who's supposed to be, you know, the Sharia officer going around the streets of Raqqa, he ain't gonna fucking do it. So you have to cut off their cash flow, and a practical way to do that is simply destroy the fucking oil fields that they have control of. Don't you, we're going to wrestle it back and we're going to have control of it. No, just fucking destroy them. Destroy them completely. To cut off their supply lines. And again, they're doing that. The third thing is, guys, you have to support the Kurds. Now, the Kurds have been consistent all along. They are, you know, a bulwark in the region against ISIS. And, of course, some of our allies, like Turkey, for example, they're fighting the Kurds as the Kurds are fighting ISIS. So, you know, they're questionable in this whole scenario as well. But the Kurds have been consistent all along. No flip-flopping, no bullshit, no going behind your back. So you have to support the Kurds. Now, it's up to you, you know, what you think is the best way to go about that, whether it's just humanitarian aid or intelligence assistance, or some people would argue for arming them. However you deem it necessary, we have to do that. You have to support the Kurds. The fourth thing is you need to have better relations with Iran and the Shia militias. Now, this is one where the Republicans are already coming out on the other side of this, and they're saying, no, let's blow up the Iran peace deal. That's the last thing you should want to do, because Iran is Shia. ISIS is fundamentalist Sunni. They want to wipe out the Shias. Again, that's one of their number one enemies. Okay, they view the Shias as heretics. They don't believe in true Islam, so let's kill them before we even get to the Western infidels. This is their ideology. So you have a natural ally. Why not, you know, actually mend fences and work with them on this? Now, again, some people say, well, they're just as radical, but that's simply not true. If you listen to what ISIS says, they want a global caliphate. Whether or not they could get that is a separate question, but that's what they say they want. Whereas when you look at the Shias in Iran, yes, they have a fucked up theocracy there, but they don't have any goals beyond, you know, a regionally contained situation, beyond a nationalistic goal. And in the same way, the Taliban is like that as well. The Taliban, while yes, they believe in Sharia and they believe in, you know, in dominating the region, and they are a terrorist organization, their goals are more regional and nationalistic than a global caliphate. And that there's a fundamental difference there. You know that Iran, for all of their flaws, they're going to be an ally in trying to destroy ISIS. So, of course, you should use this as an opportunity to mend fences with Iran and to get it so that while we all agree on the enemy and we come together and we work in a united sense. All right, the next thing is we need to stop supporting the mythological so-called moderate Sunni force in Syria, because they ain't fucking there anymore. You know, Obama recently stopped one of the programs that was meant to help these guys because it didn't fucking work. They said, all right, we need to train thousands of moderate Sunnis to topple Assad and fight ISIS. What happened? I'm not kidding. Four people were trained by the U.S. Four people. And then the people who were trained, the second they got into Syria, they handed over all their weapons to al-Nusra, who is the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. There are no more moderate rebels in Syria. I'm sorry to burst your bubble if you don't know the facts, but this is something that was reported a year and a half ago. The Daily Beast had an article saying, guys, they're not there anymore. The FSA has fled to Turkey and they fled to Europe. Now it's just ISIS and al-Nusra and other ragtag jihadist groups fighting Assad. So you have to stop trying to prop up a mythical third force there. And of course, that means de facto, apart from staying out of the region, if you should support Russia in their attacks against ISIS, because that's who they're bombing right now, and they're bombing other jihadists as well. And you should, although Assad's a bad guy, you don't want to do a repeat of Iraq. What happened in Iraq? We toppled the dictator, and then something worse came out of the vacuum. Well, what's going to happen in Syria? You topple Assad, something worse is going to come out of the vacuum. It's a choice between the lesser of two evils in this scenario. And to say we want to topple Assad to create a vacuum, and then we hope that whoever comes in that vacuum is going to be pro-America and pro-West, that's nonsense. It's not going to fucking happen. Stop dreaming. You're thinking like children if you believe that. And unfortunately, that's how Washington is thinking right now. All right, the next thing is, and I kind of alluded to it there, you have an opportunity to make up with Russia here. You have an opportunity to support their war on ISIS. Now, we've been saying all along, we've been at war, so-called war on terror, for well over a decade now. And it's gotten worse since we've done it. So why not give somebody else a shot? Why not let Russia do it? Why not now? France wants to get involved for goddamn good reasons. So why not let them do it? And why not use this as an opportunity to sit down together and work things out and realize we have a common enemy who we can come together over? And there are some signs that that's already happening. There are some articles that say there's a, you know, an agreement that's beginning to get crafted between Obama and Putin. They were talking at the recent G20 summit where, you know, they're saying, okay, we got to do some sort of power sharing thing with Assad staying in power and then maybe getting some other force there to, you know, tie up loose ends and create a more stable situation. So they're beginning to look like they're going down this road. But again, this is something that should have been done a long time ago. But now perhaps with such an incredible terrorist attack that happened in France, people are realizing, oh, shit, maybe Russia isn't our enemy. Maybe, you know, we can work together against this. Okay, next. You need to threaten your economic relationship with the Saudis. And I say that because we know, as a matter of fact, that there are people within the Saudi government who are funding international jihad. They are funding Salafi Islam all around the world. That's the problem. That's the cancer. That's the virus. Okay, and we are dumping money on their lap because we're addicted to the oil. So you have to say, hey man, you know, purge your government and purge the powers that be of all the people who you know are bad actors, who you know support ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other jihadist groups, or else. And that or else is we break up. Sorry, but our economic relationship is no longer here. Sorry, but, you know, you wanted help in Yemen. Well, we're out of helping you in Yemen. We're out of buying all your products. Now, I know this is a difficult thing to do because we're so intertwined economically, but you're going to have to start getting away from that sooner or later because even without this situation, climate change is enough where we know we can't be stuck on fossil fuels forever. We're going to have to go towards green technology, so it's an absolute necessity. All right, next, you should support France in their response so long as it's smart and targeted. So right now, like we said, they're bombing Raqqa. That happened very quickly after this incident. And the list of places they bombed so far, I haven't seen anything unacceptable. Again, they say there's zero civilian casualties. If the news changes, of course, we'll report on that. But, you know, I always say I'm a non-interventionist, and the only time I believe in force is for self-defense. Well, France just got attacked in the most egregious way possible. Do I think they should ground invade? No, because I don't think that'll work. I think it'll make the problem worse. But is France justified in responding by bombing the ISIS capital and we're hearing that there's zero civilian casualties? Well, yeah, why not? So support them, but you have to, again, you have to be smart about this and you have to make sure that your attacks are targeted. Because if they're not targeted, then you're going to make the problem worse, and that's the last thing that all of us want. And there's also, by the way, just a side note here. Some people are saying the reason why ISIS is now lashing out against the West and trying to do these attacks in the West is that some of the areas they recently lost. The Kurds took back some places from them recently. They lost Kobani. So now the idea is, well, they're desperate because they lost on that front, so now they're attacking this way. I don't know if that's true, but that's food for thought. But either way, support France in their response as long as it's smart and targeted. All right, next. This is number 9 here, by the way, so you could tell I thought about this quite a bit and how to respond. Use special forces. Special forces work to get bin Laden. Special forces are the most highly trained people in the world. If anybody's going to get the job done in a precise way, it's them. Now, I'm not the kind of person who says skirt international law and use them whenever and wherever if you have the whim to use them. No, you have to abide by international law. You have to do the proper things with the proper oversight and go through Congress when necessary and get UN approval when necessary. All that stuff still stands. I don't believe in violating international law. But yes, use special forces for high-value targets. And That's a way where you can attack the problem in a pragmatic way and limit civilian casualties as much as possible. And I think if you do that, the world is going to be with you. So I think that's an important move as well. And then we have number 10 is rigorous immigration vetting. Now, this one, you're having a big fight between the left and the right now. There's Republican governors today are saying, we're gonna take in no Syrian refugees. And, you know, the idea is, well, they're going to be terrorists. They're all going to be terrorists. Oh, ooh, Alabama is saying no more. I mean, they were only going to take in like fucking 12 anyway. But is there a legitimate concern there? Absolutely, there's a legitimate concern. It is true, or at least some of the preliminary evidence suggests that one of the guys that did this attack had a fake passport from Syria. We don't have all the information on that, but if we get more information, I'll make sure to report on it for you guys. So is there a legitimate concern? Yes. But would I cut off all immigration from refugees? No, because they're obviously not all terrorists, and the ones who are not are clearly fleeing ISIS terrorism, and they're fleeing a war zone because they don't want to be in a chaotic state. They want to have peace and stability. So naturally, they're going to try to come to places where there's more peace and stability. Now, I'm not one of those liberals who says, you know, who's not pragmatic or practical about this, where they say, yeah, bro, let everybody in and don't, you know, let them in first and then ask questions later. No, you have to do it in a smart way where you do rigorous vetting to make sure that there's no creepy stuff in anybody's past. Because even if 1% of the refugees are radicalized and might do something, you know, bad, that's a huge number overall that are potentially really dangerous people. So you don't just go full progressive and let everybody in and, you know, we'll get to it later where we do background checks and whatnot. No, you need to be rigorous up front. Some people have suggested you set up a system in Turkey. A lot of refugees are in Turkey right now and Lebanon. You set up a system there where there's a process by which you allow refugees in after a background check. Something like that I'd definitely be in favor of. I would not go full conservative and cut off all the refugees. I would not go full progressive and say, let them all in and then later we'll think about it. There's a middle ground there where we need to be rational about this, and I think that's the best way to go about it. Do rigorous immigration vetting. And then number 11 and the final thing here is, and this is for the broader ideological war that's going on, you gotta focus on de-radicalization. Now, that's easier said than done. I understand that. But it's clear that there are multiple factors that lead a given terrorist to do what they do. Sometimes it's purely religious and ideological. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's based on revenge and retribution, and you fucked up my country, so I'm going to go get you. And it's based on, you know, having no opportunity and all hope is lost and living in extreme poverty and all this stuff. But in most cases, it's probably a mix. Okay, so you do have extreme poverty and you have no hope, but then that's also coupled with a radical ideology, a fundamentalist Islamic ideology of jihad. And what we need to do is try to win on both fronts. So, of course, we need to try to fix the scenario where people are growing up with no hope and they're living in poverty and they have no shot. And also, we need to fight that ideological battle, and we shouldn't be kneecapped when we try to do it. When somebody says, hey, there's a problem in Islamic ideology and we need to argue against that and say that's not acceptable in the modern age, no, we shouldn't immediately say that person's being Islamophobic. Well, what if they're just arguing against the ideas and the concepts of fundamentalist Islamic ideology? That's perfectly rational, and that's only exactly what people do all the time with Christianity. And in the case of Christianity, it was beaten over the head so much with the stick of enlightenment that eventually they're like, okay, all right, we got to give up. We're cowered in the corner, whatever, let the scientists take over and let the democracy believers take over. Same thing, man. There's got to be a movement towards secularism within Islam. The problem is not Islam. The problem is Islamism, which is political Islam, or jihad, which is, you know, a violent means of trying to implement Sharia, which is political Islam. So again, on the de-radicalization front, we have to win in the war of ideas. And I know that this is not something like, you know, somebody who's radicalized is going to listen to me now and go, he convinced me. But in the long run, if more people are pushing out these ideas, well, then we have a better chance of success. All right, and finally, let me leave you with this. I spoke to my friend who's a former Islamist about this because he has an interesting perspective to comment on it, being somebody who at one time was radicalized and now he's not. And I want to tell you some of the stuff that he said to me. He said, quote, "It now makes sense to defeat ISIS because they are a threat, but intelligently, not stupidly. I strongly oppose an invasion to get ISIS. That's what they want. They're not like the Taliban. The second there's an invasion, ISIS will be in the wind. Invasion will create huge new problems, will be a tool for ISIS to recruit, and all those ISIS people in the wind will terrorize the world to a level we've never seen. I like an all-Muslim and Shia-Sunni coalition of local forces, Saudi, Turkish, Iranian, to gather and go after ISIS. The West can support in non-combative ways, providing financial arms and humanitarian assistance, maybe with special ops to take care of high-value targets or missions. This is pretty much, as Bernie Sanders said, is for the soul of Islam to solve. I 100% agree. We shouldn't be stupid and do something to demonize all Muslims, like profiling all Muslims or surveillance in mosques or anything like that. Terrorists aren't stupid to fall for them, and it only pisses the average Muslims off, which is, again, what terrorists want. We shouldn't make the life of Muslims any more difficult than it already is and will become inevitably. When it comes to Islam itself, gloves are off. While we shouldn't piss off Muslims with bad and discriminating policies, we should make it clear that certain parts of Islam are problematic, and hiding from it or pretending they don't exist will not be enough." Hear, hear. So that's a very balanced approach here. As I've said before, guys, you know my stance on U.S. intervention. We've already been intervening for over a decade, and we made it worse. And furthermore, from a principled perspective, I think the only time the U.S. should use our force alone is when there's a direct threat of violence against us, and it's self-defense. So, given that that's the case, if the U.S. wants to support our allies in a variety of different ways, with intelligence and with, you know, aid and stuff like that, and in some cases, like maybe with the Kurds arming, fine, fine, fine. But the idea that as a result of this, well, we need to go after it, and we need to fight, and we need to ground invade and everything. No. You have to learn the lessons of Iraq, and you have to learn that we've been doing airstrikes, we've been involved militarily, and it's been worse. The outcome has been worse. But having said that, this is a clear attack on France. It's as obvious as it gets. And the numbers are ridiculous, and the extent of the damage is incomprehensible. So, again, if France wants to be targeted and specific in getting more involved and going after ISIS, by all means, I support them 100%. And also, like I said, and I laid out for you guys, this is for the moderate Muslims, the moderate Sunnis, and the Shias, and the other states in the region to solve. And I would also back Russia with their attempt to get more involved here. So we have a united front against ISIS with other players taking the lead. That's my solution to this. All right. Well, that was long. Let me take a break. When we come back, I got a trillion things to get to. Stay right there, guys. bitch. All right, we're back. Quick break, I know, but I got so much stuff I got to get to. Shut her up, bro. All right, good. Ted Cruz responded to the Paris terror attacks in the worst possible way. He released a statement where he said this, quote, "We must immediately recognize that our enemy is not violent extremism. It is the radical Islamism that has declared jihad against the West. It will not be appeased by outreach or declarations of tolerance. It will not be deterred by targeted airstrikes with zero tolerance for civilian casualties." All right, so the first part of that, not bad. He didn't, you know, steer it off into a ditch yet. But then at the end of it, oh no, that was the exact wrong response, Ted. Look at what he said. I'll repeat it. It will not be deterred by targeted airstrikes with zero tolerance for civilian casualties. So, in other words, after the disastrous terror attack in France, well, we can accept more civilian casualties, can't we? We cannot give a fuck as much about civilian casualties on the ground, right? I mean, we're talking about, like, Iraq here. We're talking about Syria. We're talking about, like, Yemen and whatnot. Who gives a fuck? Am I right? Am I right? No, you're wrong. You're wrong. Because that will further exacerbate the problem. Now, you're right that part of the problem, if not a bulk of the problem, is the ideology itself, the fundamentalist Islamic ideology itself. But you know what would exacerbate that and make it worse and have the opposite of the intended effect? If you start wantonly bombing civilians or you don't care about civilian casualties. Because then when you end up killing somebody's mom or sister or grandma, apart from being immoral, you have people who go, well, I wasn't against the Americans, but then they're the ones that did the airstrike that killed my family members or my friends, so now give me an AK-47. Now I want revenge. Now I'm going to go back against them. Now, again, as I said, some of the violence is purely religious and ideological. There's no doubt about that. I'm the first person to call that out. But if you kill somebody's family, there's a good chance they're going to want revenge and retribution, and they will do it along with or under the guise of the fundamentalist religious ideology and spreading jihad. That ideology doesn't become attractive to many people unless you give them some sort of overwhelming traumatic life event that pushes them down that road. And we know that this is the case because we've seen the evidence. We've discussed it before on the show, but after the war on terror, we did this so much. After we began the war on terror, I should say, we did this so much. We killed so many civilians that you increase the number of terrorists. That's a fact. You know, if you would think, hey, we started the war on terror, you know, in the early 2000s. Is it fixed yet? Have we gotten rid of terrorism? All right. No, we've made it worse. We had Al-Qaeda, which was bad enough, but then the monstrosity of ISIS, which is worse than Al-Qaeda, came out of the vacuum that we created in Iraq. And a lot of that had to do with the brazen killing of civilians, along with the de-bathification of the government and getting rid of Saddam, who was the stabilizing force in the region, even though he was a bad guy. So, Ted, way to take the exact wrong conclusion out of this. I mean, it's pathetic and sad and terrible, and this is why you should never be president. Okay. Now we go to Mike Huckabee. Mike Huckabee responded to the terror attacks in Paris in a horrific way. He released a long statement detailing what he thinks are the policy solutions, and he's wrong about most of them, but here's the funniest one. He said, quote, "Revoke any agreement with Iran regarding their nuclear capacity. Radical Islamists, whether Sunni or Shia, are a clear and present danger to civilization." I want you to think about how stupid that is, guys. Okay, I have a little conspiracy theory on this as well. I don't think that he was going to add the part about Sunni or Shia, and then one of his staffers put it in there. Because I don't think he knows that Iran is Shia and ISIS is Sunni, and, Al-Qaeda is Sunni, and you have this dichotomy and this breakdown in the Muslim world, and Iran is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, enemies of ISIS. I don't think he knew that. So I think he said the first part, like, oh my God, we need to get rid of this nuclear deal, because it's related, even though it's not. And then one of his staffers was like, yeah, I got that, bro, and he started writing it down. He's like, okay, I gotta add that, pretend like he knows the difference between Sunni and Shia. Yet, no, that would be the opposite of what you'd want to do. ISIS would love it if you ripped up that nuclear agreement with Iran. You see, if we strengthen our relationship with Iran to fight ISIS, possibly work in defeating ISIS. Again, other than the Kurds, one of the most consistent forces in the region against ISIS, it's Iran and the Shia militias that they back who are fighting ISIS. And we're supporting them in Iraq. Now, we get weird and kooky when we switch over the border into Syria, and we're trying to find the mythical moderate Sunni force. But at least in Iraq, we realize, okay, no, these are the guys who we want to work with. Iran, for all of their flaws, and they have many, they are a theocracy, they do have backwards laws, no doubt about it. But for all of their flaws, they do not have global caliphate ambitions, so you can work with them in that sense. Whereas ISIS or Al-Qaeda, they do have global caliphate ambitions, so you can't work with them. Iran cares about regional dominance and cares about their nation. That's what they care about. And again, they have many problems. I'm not excusing them, but they don't want to come to Nebraska and overtake it and hoist the ISIS flag in the capital. They don't want to do that. They're not interested in that. And see, this shows the ignorance of guys like Mike Huckabee, because he's wholly unaware that one of the first people to condemn the attacks was Hassan Rouhani, the leader of Iran. And right after the Paris attacks, this is grotesque, this isn't right. You also have this really going to, conservatives' minds are going to explode. You know who else condemned the attacks? I hope you're sitting. Hezbollah and Hamas. Now you could say, well, there's hypocrisy because they're killing other people, blah, 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 blah. That may all be true. But they did stand up and say, no, that's not right. That is un-Islamic. We don't like that. Again, they have a trillion and one problems and a million areas where I disagree with them elsewhere. But they did stand up and say, no, that's not right. And remember, there was an attack in Lebanon just before this attack in Paris, and it was in Beirut, and over 40 people were killed. These are Shia Muslims. This ISIS Sunni bomber came in there, blew them up. So the Shias are with us on this. They're with us on this. They can be our partner in fighting them, and don't you want them to fight ISIS as opposed to sending somebody from Michigan to fight ISIS? I thought you cared about our troops. Do you care about our troops or not? No, the best thing to do is strengthen your relationship with Iran, because we have a common enemy. Same thing with Russia. Strengthen your relationship with Russia, because as of right now, Russia's bombing ISIS. Why would you not want to strengthen your relationship? But in typical dumbass conservative fashion, he's like, I don't know, Sunni, Shia, whatever's the difference. I don't even know what the fuck's going on, man. The radical Islamists, they all bad. Break off all the good ties that we've created because Muslims. Okay, next. Oh God, it's going to get ugly, man. We got more ugliness here. Baptist pastor Stephen Anderson spoke about the terror attacks in a sermon on Sunday. And it got ugly.
I'm deeply religious, and I felt like the devil had given me a song. He's talking about songwriting. I'm deeply religious, and I felt like the devil had given me this song. So his religion's to worship the devil. Right. Eagles of Death Metal is the name of the band. And the Bible says in Proverbs, all they that hate me love death. Being of God. Those who hate God love death. You know, there's something about when you go to a concert of death metal, somebody might get killed.
Right.
You know, you're worshiping death. And then all of a sudden people start dying. Oh, wait a minute. What's going on? Well, you love death so much that you bought the ticket?
Yeah.
You love worshiping Satan? Well, let's have some of Satan's religion come in and shoot you. I mean, that's what these people should think about before they go to such a wicked concert. And look, I'm not condoning what these Islamic murderers did. They're wicked. They're murderers. But you know what? Nobody should be at a concert worshiping Satan with this drug-pushing hillbilly faggot. And that's what he is. I mean, all you have to do is just Google this band. Somebody told me, somebody emailed me and said, just hit Google Images, Eagles of Death Metal. And these guys are just total sodomite-looking freaks. You know, but nobody thinks about that. It's just, oh, no. Let's stand with France. No, France is a sinful, wicked nation. Let me tell you a little bit about France.
Unreal. Unreal. I mean, that is victim blaming if I've ever seen it. And then you have the obligatory throw-in. Now, I'm not justifying the murders, but let me go on to justify the murders. We've called this guy before Hitler pastor or Nazi pastor because he's given speeches where he said, for example, kill all the transgender people. I think he might have said that about Jews, too. Kill all the Jews. Kill all the transgender people. This guy is a lunatic. He's a pastor in Arizona, a fundamentalist Baptist pastor. But what's really interesting is you can see the relationship in ideology between what he believes and what jihadists believe. Now, again, is there a fundamental difference where, you know, this guy hasn't actually killed anybody? Yes. Would I trust this guy if he got power? Fuck no, because he might actually act on this shit if he got power. So he hasn't actually done it, and jihadists haven't actually done it, and, you know, we could get into those differences. But purely from an ideological perspective, as referenced, but, you know, as evidenced, I should say, by him saying kill transgender people, kill Jews, and all that stuff. He is almost exactly like them. Because look at the point he's making. He's saying, well, I mean, sure, terrorist attack, bad, whatever. But they were in a death metal band. They worship death. So I'm not saying they had it coming, but maybe they had it coming. No, no, no. They didn't have it coming. Nobody has it coming. I don't know if you know this big guy, but that's music. Just because, you know, you sing a song about anything doesn't mean that that's necessarily the case in real life. Okay, that's like saying, well, you went to go see Rambo. People are getting shot in Rambo. You know, what do you expect? So obviously somebody's going to come in the theater and shoot you up because you're watching Rambo. There's a lot of death on screen. You're sinning. I mean, what are you going to do? That's what's going to happen in real life. Am I right? No, you're wrong. It's entertainment. You know, whether it's a movie or it's music, that's not the same as real life. That's why when you kill somebody, when you're playing Halo or Rainbow Six, you don't get brought up on murder charges because you didn't actually fucking murder somebody. So if you make death metal music or you make a movie where people get hurt, you're not guilty of anything, but that's the point, is that he thinks that that's an evil on its own. That's an evil on its own, and he thinks that the band is gay or whatever, too. He's like, oh, these faggots! So in other words, he's like, well, I mean, come on, they were gay. Maybe they were asking for a little bit. And they were doing music. Music is evil. That's exactly what the jihadists said, too. You know, music, under their interpretation of Islam, music is haram. Evil. Bad. Can't do it. So this guy's like, maybe they have it right. Maybe they have it right. I'm not saying they have it right. I'm not with the Islamic terrorists. They're bad people. But, I mean, fuck. He was in a death metal band. Hello, guys. It wasn't like a gospel band. If it was gospel music, then obviously, you know, they're angelic and you can never kill them. That'd be wrong. But, come on. He may have worshipped the devil. If he worshipped the devil... France is a filthy country, isn't it? He also goes on to say, well, look, again, I'm not saying they asked for it, but France does do abortions. Dude, you know, this attack itself and the response here, it just shows you religion is poisoning it, man. The attackers said that there are some reports. Again, we don't know how clear it is because there's chaos in the aftermath of such a gigantic attack. But there's some reports that say they were targeting apostates before anybody else. So that's a religious move, an ideologically fundamentalist religious move. Okay. And also, there were some people who said, well, they also targeted certain places. There was music being played at the place. Music is haram, evil, under the ISIS caliphate, not allowed. So religious reasons. And then this guy's religious response... You know, brilliant. Same category here. Now, are there plenty of moderate religious people, Christians, Muslims, who have come out and condemned this ad nauseum? Yes. There's so many articles that showed all the different Islamic groups and individual Muslims on Twitter saying, no, I condemn this 100%. So I'm not trying to paint a broad brush here in any way, shape, or form. But what I am going to say, and what is perfectly clear to me, is that it's the fundamentalists, the people who... are conservative, far-right fundamentalists, and they're religious, who are the biggest problems here, and the attacks prove it, and a gross response like this also proves it. All right, next. Let me give you guys, it feels fucked up calling this good news because it's not. I mean, there's no good news in this scenario, but a little shining light here in the midst of all this destruction that hopefully will bring a smile to your face. So not only was there an attack in Paris on Friday, but on Thursday there was a double suicide bombing in Lebanon, in southern Beirut, which killed 43 people, 43 civilians, and injured many more. So ISIS claimed responsibility for this. So they did the double suicide bombing there. They did the attack in Paris, and also there was a suicide bombing in Iraq that killed 25 as well. That got almost no coverage. I mean, the bombing in Lebanon got almost no coverage. The one in Iraq got even less than the one in Lebanon. So, and then we also had the Paris one, which kind of overshadowed everything. And they targeted civilian markets at a really busy time. So this was, you know, planned in detail beforehand, and we have an unbelievable story of heroism in the midst of the carnage here to share with you. So after the first bomb went off, there's a guy named Adel Termos who noticed a second suicide bomber about to attack. He saw the suicide vest on the guy. And what he did is he took off running after him. He ran after him and he tackled him and absorbed the bulk of the explosion. And they say that as a result of his heroic move here, he probably saved dozens, if not hundreds of people, many families. Now, he was with his daughter at the time. Unfortunately, his daughter was too close to the situation either way, and she died. He obviously died, but he saved many people as a result of his heroism. And you know, this is an important story because it shows you that even though there's so many examples in the world of just absolute barbarism and savagery and insanity and wanton violence, while that exists, humanity is a spectrum. You know, we have a spectrum, and there may be a lot of people on that side of being out-and-out barbaric, but there's also people on that side of being absolute heroes and displaying courage and genuinely caring about the well-being of everybody around him or her. And, you know, this guy here is an absolute hero. And I would like to think that if I was in that scenario, I would act the same way. But I don't know. I don't know. And in fact, if anything, you would think that your instincts would push you in the opposite direction, where you see a guy with a suicide vest, and all you do is book it in the other direction. But this guy, you know, he dug deep somehow, and he said, not today, ran, tackled the guy, saved many people as a result of this. So, Adel Termos, thank you very much. You're a hero. We don't want to forget you. And for anybody else out there, just know it's much better to be like Adel Termos than to be like one of the barbarians who carried out these senseless, brutal attacks. All right. Next. All right, finally we're getting to the Democratic debate. How you like them apples? Let me give you my overall breakdown, and then we'll take a break, and then I'll come back and give you a speed round in the final 30 minutes. On Saturday night, we had the CBS Democratic debate, and my takeaway from it was, I have no clue. I know that sounds ridiculous, and that's because it is ridiculous, but I watched the debate twice, and, you know, I want to come out here and say, oh, Bernie won, and he fucking slammed everybody, but that wasn't my takeaway. Now, other people think he did destroy, and that's a fair opinion to have. I'm sure they can defend it, but I'm just telling you that when I try to view it through the mind of some, being as objective as possible, putting my own bias aside, everybody knows which direction my bias goes, but putting that aside and watching this as whatever your typical run-of-the-mill Democratic voter would be, or just your average voter, period. When I looked at the debate, it was amorphous. You know, it was, you had O'Malley, who was being O'Malley with his fake politician's cadence, but to be fair to him, he said some things that were true and were accurate and were smart, even though he said it in the weird, I'm faking a politician's voice way. Just a gray zone all around. Hillary had... her aura, the way she carried herself, the way she spoke, was great. You know, it was how she spoke that made a lot of people think, in my opinion, that she won the debate. But the substance of what she said, there are many ridiculous parts. I mean, I don't even need to tell you guys. I'm sure a lot of you know by now. But basically, in response to Bernie saying, hey, you take Wall Street campaign contributions and you do their bidding, she basically said, I have a vagina and 9/11. So the substance of what she said was ridiculous, way more so than anybody else on the stage. But again, it was because of how she spoke, it was amorphous to me. It was a gray area. Now, Bernie, on the other hand, he, of course, on substance, he always knocks it out of the park and destroys everybody else in the room because he's Bernie Sanders and that's what he does. But he had some moments that, in my opinion, were tone deaf in the sense that they wouldn't go over well in the general population, especially directly after a terror attack where, you know, the moderator asked him, like, oh, do you still think climate change is the biggest threat facing us? And he's like, yes. Again, I think he's right, and I think on the facts he can defend that because he's right, but it's just, that is that going to land with your average voter who just saw over 100 people get slaughtered in France by ISIS, and they show scary pictures of ISIS, I'll be afraid, they're in Nebraska. They're going to go, you're going to shit themselves and go, oh, my God, I'm not voting for him. You know, give me fucking Rick Santorum. I'm just kidding. Nobody's ever said that. But... yeah, so it just struck me as a tie overall. I'd love to say, hey, this person edged it and this person, but that's not true. At least in my opinion, it's not true. On substance, of course, Bernie won because he's Bernie. But in terms of my overall takeaway, I can't say this person did better than that person or anything like that. So that's my overall takeaway. Now, let me give you what the polls said. Now, the Snap polls directly after, so these are unscientific polls, but you know, they're worth something here, and the same as the Republican polls, I think, are worth something, even though they're not scientific, directly after. Slate had Bernie winning 81%, good googly-moogly, 13%, O'Malley 3%, and they threw in their CBS, who hosted it, 1%, and the GOP 2%. So silly that they threw that in there, but they did. Time has Bernie at 81%, again, excuse me, Hillary 14%, O'Malley 5%. And then we have Fox had Sanders 88%, Hillary 9%, O'Malley 3%. Now, those are the unscientific ones. Then we have some allegedly scientific ones, and I'll get to why that's a problem in a second and why that may not necessarily be true. But public policy polling said 67% of the 510 voters they surveyed in a allegedly scientific poll said that Clinton won, and Sanders trailed with 20%, and O'Malley got 7%. And then we have CBS News, quote, CBS News interviewed a nationally representative sample of debate watchers assembled by GFK's knowledge panel who identified themselves as Democrats or independents. By a 23-point margin, these debate watchers say Hillary won the debate. 51% say Clinton won compared to 28% who favor Sanders and just 7% pick O'Malley. 14% called it a tie. So I say allegedly scientific because for the public policy polling one, turns out that it was paid for by Correct the Record, which is described as, quote, a strategic research and rapid response team designed to defend Hillary Clinton from baseless attacks. Oh, so a Hillary super PAC paid for the scientific poll that said Hillary won. Come on, man. Come on. What the fuck is going on here? I mean, even let's say it wasn't skewed, okay? Do you not realize that just the optics of that alone are enough to dismiss it at face value? You can't have fucking a Hillary super PAC pay for a poll and then have the poll say Hillary won. That's crazy. That's like having Bush pay for a poll that says Bush was a good president. Well, why would I accept that? I wouldn't accept that. There's a bias. There's a problem there. Even if it was scientific, the way you set it up, hilariously dumb. You can't do that. All right, so this is the overall breakdown here. The snap polls have Bernie winning by a mile and a half. The so-called scientific ones have Hillary winning. I guess that somewhat backs my thesis of I took away like a weird amorphous tie here. But I will say this, man. What we need Bernie to do is, and again, I love Bernie, so it's hard for me to say this and critique him because he's done such a great job so far, and he went for, he's not taking any corporate money, but he's, you know, solidly number two in the national polls, and he's surging all the time, and he took a lead in New Hampshire and Iowa and stuff. So it's hard for me to critique him because he's doing so much, and he's doing so well, and he's sticking to the issues. But it's almost like you need him to have just utter standout debates where it's just crushing victories on his part for him to overtake on the national level and for him to surpass Hillary. Because Hillary has, she's the default vote, man. She has all the big money coming into her campaign, which means more ads, which means getting her name out there more. She already is more famous than Bernie Sanders, so she's got that fallback thing. She's got the media, which talks about her nonstop. And they don't talk about Bernie nearly as much. And when they do, it's not, you know, as positive coverage. So, it's hard, but, you know, you're going against a behemoth, Bernie. So we need, and all the supporters, too, and I'll end on this. It's the supporters, man. He's going to do his part, and he's going to do his best, and I have full faith and confidence in him. But the supporters, you cannot get lackadaisical. You cannot look at the fact that he won the snap polls and go, great, we can rest. Bitch, you better go make some phone calls or go on Facebook and talk about it or donate to his campaign because you know he's not taking any money from multinational corporations and Wall Street, or double down and fight harder because, you know, the second that you take your foot off the gas pedal, obviously the Clinton machine is going to overtake and destroy. So keep that in mind, and we'll see what happens from here. All right, let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, I still got a bunch of stories to get to. All right, just stick around. We'll be right back.
We're the ones they left, yes, nothing but trouble. Cold of a touch, but just warm as a devil. On my heart, but you won't hear my soul. She takes till I break and I can't get more. You got me in chains. You got me in chains for your love. But I wouldn't change. No, I wouldn't change this love. Got me in chains. You got me in chains for your love.
Thank you.
right, guys, we're back. We're not done with the debate yet. That was just the overall breakdown that I gave you before. Here, we'll get to some specific clips. Let's do it. Bernie Sanders was asked about terrorism during the CBS Democratic debate, and he had an interesting answer.
In the previous debate, you said the greatest threat to national security was climate change. Do you still believe that?
Absolutely. In fact, climate change is directly related to the growth of terrorism. And if we do not get our act together and listen to what the scientists say, you're going to see countries all over the world. This is what the CIA says. They're going to be struggling over limited amounts of water, limited amounts of land to grow their crops, and you're going to see all kinds of international conflict. But of course, international terrorism is a major issue that we have got to address today. And I agree with much of what the Secretary and Governor have said. Let me have one area of disagreement with the Secretary. I think she said something like, the bulk of the responsibility is not ours. Well, in fact, I would argue that the disastrous invasion of Iraq, something that I strongly oppose, has unraveled the region completely and led to the rise of Al-Qaeda and to ISIS. Now, in fact, what we have got to do, and I think there is widespread agreement here, is the United States cannot do it alone. What we need to do is lead an international coalition, which includes, very significantly, the Muslim nations in that region who are going to have to fight and defend their way of life.
All right, so I think he's right with every single point he made there, but I don't know if it'll go over well. And that's what, you know, is what always happens whenever there's some sort of disaster, and specifically something like the atrocity that happened in Paris, which was a terrorist attack and so many people were killed. Historically, that leads to the rise of the right. Now, I don't know if that'll necessarily happen in the U.S. I'm almost certain it's going to happen in France, and it's going to happen throughout Europe. It already has to a certain extent, but I think it's going to happen even more. And, you know, the nuanced, detailed, smart answers like that, typically people want more of like a revenge, retribution, let's go get them kind of response at a time like this. And that's just an innate, natural, you know, instinct, maybe a human instinct that a lot of people have when stuff like this happens. So everything he said there was true, but I'm not sure it'll go over well. Like, should the countries in the region largely lead the fight against ISIS? Yes. And to a certain extent they are, whether it's the Shia militias or it's the Kurds. Obviously, to a lesser degree, you have, like, Turkey involved, even though they're mostly attacking the Kurds, which is the opposite of what they should do. But, like, yeah, the countries in the region should take care of it, and it's a fight for the soul of Islam. Totally agree. But is that something people want to hear right now? I don't know. The point on Iraq leading to the rise of ISIS. Now, guys, don't get it twisted. He's not saying that it was the invasion of Iraq which created the ideology of Wahhabism, and that was America pushing it all along. No, that's a caricature, a straw man of what he said. What he's saying is, we broke the region, and as a result of that, there was a power vacuum, and this monstrosity rose up out of the power vacuum. He's not saying the U.S. is to blame for Salafism or Wahhabism. He's saying that our policies destabilized the region, created a power vacuum, and they rose up out of it. That's what he's saying. So don't strawman him in that sense. And that's totally true. What he's saying is totally true there. But again, will it go over well? I don't know, because the timing of it. And then to climate change is the biggest threat we face. It's like, again, I do think that's true, and there's a fantastic argument that's, in my opinion, been proven that as a result of climate change, you have a lot of this instability, and a lot of the Arab Spring came about as a result of that. Now, you might laugh at that, but just know that in Syria, for example, the people who were not working in the cities, well, they had to move to the cities because the land dried up and there were all these problems as a result of climate change, so they moved into the cities. There were no jobs available, so that's when you started to have murmurs of revolution because, you know, what is it? The government's not taking care of us. We're in trouble here. What are we going to do? And then you had the uprising. So, again, all that is true. It's true that climate change is a big threat, if not the biggest threat that we face, because it will lead to more war. It will lead to an increase in food prices. It will lead to more natural disasters. But is it something that's going to go over well given the timing of it and given historically how people feel directly after an attack. I don't think it will. And, you know, it's almost like he's put in a corner as a result of the timing period, and there's nothing he could do about it, because just the way he phrased that question, it was a fair question from the moderator. It really is a fair question, but it's almost like because of the timing, it is a gotcha question. And again, I'm not saying he shouldn't have asked it, because he should have. That's a fine question to ask. But it just, it's bordering on that, because there's no good answer to that given what just happened in Paris. So Bernie's right on all that stuff, but is it going to go over well? Is it going to win hearts and minds, so to speak, given the timing of it? I don't think so. And this is going to be an uphill battle for him to fight from here on out. All right, next. Let's get to Hillary now and her ridiculous answers here. Money in politics was discussed at the Democratic debate on CBS, and Hillary had some abysmal moments.
Sanders, you said that the donations to Secretary Clinton are compromising. So what do you think of her answer?
Not good enough. Here's the story. I mean, you know, let's not be naive about it. Why over her political career has Wall Street been a major, the major, a campaign contributor to Hillary Clinton? Now, maybe they're dumb and they don't know what they're going to get, but I don't think so. Here is the major issue when we talk about Wall Street. It ain't complicated. You got six financial institutions today that have assets of 56%, equivalent to 56% of the GDP in America. They issue two-thirds of the credit cards and one-third of the mortgages. If Teddy Roosevelt, the good Republican, were alive today, you know what he'd say? Break them up. Reestablish Glass-Steagall. If Teddy Roosevelt is right, that is the issue. Now, I am the only candidate up here that doesn't have a super PAC. I'm not asking Wall Street or the billionaires for money. I will break up these banks, support community banks and credit unions, that's the future of banking in America.
Quick follow-up, because Secretary McClinton, you'll get a chance to respond. You said they know what they're going to get. What are they going to get?
I have never heard a kid, never, who's received huge amounts of money from oil, from coal, from Wall Street, from the military-industrial complex. Not one candidate said, oh, these campaign contributions will not influence me. I'm going to be independent. Well, why do they make millions of dollars of campaign contributions? They expect to get something. Everybody knows that. Once again, I am running a campaign differently than any other candidate. We are relying on small campaign donors, 750,000 of them, $30 a piece. That's who I'm indebted.
Well, John, wait a minute. He has basically used his answer to impugn my integrity. Let's be frank here. Oh, wait a minute, Senator. You know, not only do I have hundreds of thousands of donors, most of them small, and I'm very proud that for the first time, a majority of my donors are women, 60%. I represented New York, and I represented New York on 9/11. When we were attacked, where were we attacked? We were attacked in downtown Manhattan, where Wall Street is. I did spend a whole lot of time and effort helping them rebuild. That was good for New York. It was good for the economy. And it was a way to rebuke the terrorists who had attacked our country. So
she just used 9/11 and her vagina to explain away Wall Street donations. That's insulting to everybody. Guys, she was the number three recipient of Wall Street cash in the Senate before the terror attacks, before the attacks. Her number one contributor was Citigroup. So what she's saying is also not true, apart from just being ridiculous, apart from being insulting, I should say, to the American people. And I had to take the Wall Street contributions because 9/11 happened. So what am I supposed to do? How is that related at all? But again, you were taking money. Your number one contributor before that was Citigroup. So that doesn't make any sense. Would you have a crystal ball and say, ooh, I know there's going to be an attack. Citigroup, give me money, because if you give me money when the terrorist attack happens, what? Finish that line of thought. There's nothing there. No, the worst thing about this is you know it was pre-planned. You don't come up with that on the spot. That's something where you got to come up with something that's a trump card if you get called out for the thing that is you're most clearly guilty on. So what does she do? 6% of my donors are women. What are you against women? So don't disagree with me here. And, 9/11. There was the meme going around the internet of Lois Griffin on Family Guy, how when she ran for some office in one of the episodes, she says at one point in the anniversary, 9/11. Everybody's like, it's a sad, sleazy political trick. And also, that's totally misleading to say 60% of my donors are women, because that just means of the donors themselves. That doesn't mean the dollar amount. You're getting most of your money from big banks and multinational corporations and billionaires and rich people. That's where most of your money's coming from. In terms of people, it might be a majority women, but that doesn't mean that they're giving you the bulk of your money. You're getting the bulk of your money from the establishment who you've thoroughly sold out to. And make no mistake about it, even today, 4 out of 5 of her top contributors, for her most recent numbers, are Wall Street. So she received over $1 million in campaign cash from Wall Street before 9/11. And you might say, well, you know, but maybe she's right on the point that, hey, this doesn't affect me. That's not true. You can't say that this it leads me to do favoritism and, you know, leads me to be corrupt. And you can't say these are legal bribes, essentially. Well, sure you can. And your record shows it. So, for example, you know, you supported the bailouts. You supported a bankruptcy bill that was loved by Wall Street because it biases the system in favor of them, in favor of the corporations. Elizabeth Warren fought you on that and lobbied you before she was in Congress and lobbied you on behalf of the people to say, look, you can't support this. This is going to fuck over the average Joe. And you're like, oh, rock and roll. Yeah, totally with you. And what did she do? She at first voted on the side of the people, but then later on she voted against it. She voted against the people, I should say, for the bill. So, no, of course this manifests. And it's not just with Wall Street either, guys. Keep it in perspective. She takes money from private prisons, too. So, you know, what do you think is going to happen there? Who's more likely to reform private prisons? Bernie Sanders, who's taken $0 and 0 cents from private prisons, or Hillary Clinton, who's taken money from private prisons? You know, that's an outrage that we even have private prisons in the United States of America. What a perverse incentive. You're going to want to lock people up because now it's profitable to lock people up. So that's where you get, like, three strikes laws and stuff like that from. Because you have the private prison lobby trying to get different state legislatures to make more things illegal so they can lock more people up. And Hillary Clinton's taking money from them, and then she turns around like, I'm with Black Lives Matter. Really? Then why are you in favor of for-profit policing? That's one of the main things in Campaign Zero that they say they're against. So, no, I'm not – this is crazy. I mean, she really just argued, I have a vagina, 9/11, to respond to the fact that she's bought off by Wall Street. If there was ever any question in your mind beforehand as to whether or not she was bought off by Wall Street, now there shouldn't be, because it's obvious with a response like that, along with her record. All right, next. All right, this will be the last one on the debate. Let's go to Bernie Sanders. This is his something on his tax plan here. Bernie Sanders was asked about his tax plan at the Democratic debate. Let's look at his answer.
You want to make public college free altogether. You want to increase Social Security benefits. And you want to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. So you said that to do some of these things, you'll impose a tax on top earners. How high would their rate go in the Sanders administration?
Let me put those proposals, and you're absolutely right. That is what I want to do. That is what has to happen if we're going to revitalize and build the crumbling middle class. In the last 30 years, there has been a massive redistribution of wealth. And I know that term gets my Republican friends nervous. Problem is, this redistribution has gone in the wrong direction. Trillions of dollars have gone from the middle class and working families to the top one-tenth of 1% who have doubled the percentage of wealth they now own. Yes, I do believe that we must end corporate loopholes such that that major corporations year after year pay virtually zero in federal income tax because they're stashing the money in the Cayman Islands. Yet, I do believe there must be a tax on Wall Street speculation. We bailed out Wall Street. It's their time to bail out the middle class, help our kids be able to go to college tuition-free. So we pay for this by Zoom demanding that the wealthiest people and the largest corporations have gotten away with murder for years, stop paying their fair share.
Well, let's get specific. How high would you go? You said before you'd go above 50%. How high?
We haven't come up with an exact number yet, but it will not be as high as the number under Dwight D. Eisenhower, which was 90%. But it will be. I'm not that much of a socialist compared to Eisenhower. We are going to end the absurdity, as Warren Buffett often reminds us.
That's right.
That billionaires pay an effective tax rate lower than nurses or truck drivers. That makes no sense at all. There has to be real tax reform, and the wealthiest and large corporations will pay when I'm president.
All right, so at first, I didn't like that response, and I'll explain why. And it was I was tweeting this during the debate and stuff, because when you mention Eisenhower's 90% tax rate and you leave the taste in people's mouths that, like, I might not do that, but, like, I might come close to it, that's not enough context to make people feel good about what you're trying to do, because all people will take away from that is, well, so what, does he want to tax us at, like, 80%? That's fucking crazy. And the reason why I didn't like it at first is because you need to explain what that 90% rate was. It's a marginal rate. It's not your regular rate. And that would be crazy if that was somebody's regular rate. That's damn near communism to say, I'm going to take 90% of your money. No, Eisenhower wasn't taking 90% of people's money. The 90% rate is what's called a marginal tax rate, which means that your first few million dollars, whether it's $2 million, $3 million, $5 million, whatever it is, that's taxed at a lower rate, whatever number that is, 30%, maybe 35%, 40%. But then everything above that $3 million or $4 million number, let's say, that would be taxed at 90%. So your first $3 or $4 million, you know, you'd be rich. Hey, I'm rich. Look, I made millions of dollars. And everything above that is taxed at the higher rate. And so I didn't like it at first because he leaves the taste in people's mouths that, number one, Eisenhower took 90% of people's money, and number two, that he might take like 70 or 80% of people's money. And without the proper context and perspective on that, honestly, that sounds crazy. Like, your average Republican voter heard that and went, what the fuck? Like, 80, 90%? That's fucking crazy. And I would say it's crazy, too, if that was the normal rate. But he's not talking about a normal rate. He's talking about a marginal rate. And that's why you need more time, I should say, to answer that. Because it's not enough to do, like, a minute soundbite or, like, a witty thing to try to explain a detailed tax policy. Now, having said that, at the time I didn't like it. Now I actually kind of like the answer. I still think it needs more context, and you need to explain what a marginal rate is and stuff, but it wasn't bad because of the audience reaction. Now, I'm big on, I know some people aren't, but I'm actually big on what the reaction of the audience is. I think that's a microcosm of how the rest of people in America are reacting. It's not perfect, but it's a good enough indication. And they were laughing because perhaps when they hear, like, you know, Eisenhower, Republican president, that's what he was doing. Well, maybe if Bernie's not even doing that much, then maybe that... maybe it's not so bad, and maybe even the political spectrum had to shift it to the right big time. Because if Eisenhower, who's a Republican, was, you know, allegedly such a socialist, and Bernie Sanders isn't as much as him, well, then, wow, we've gone way far to the right. And the reaction in the room was more like, you know, more like he's keeping it real and saying something that nobody else ever says, which is true. So my initial reaction was, I don't like it. My second reaction is, well, maybe it didn't go over as bad as I thought it did, and I overthought it a little bit here. But either way, I would like more context because I want everybody to understand the difference between a marginal tax rate and a normal tax rate. And there are good people who know a lot about politics who don't know the difference between a marginal rate and a regular rate. And also, when you account for all the loopholes and stuff, even under Eisenhower, the marginal rate was not 90%. When you account for the loopholes and the deductions, the marginal rate was about 43%. So you know, a big chunk off that, too. But that's another conversation for another day. And finally, let me just say this. I hate the how would you pay for questions because they're just – it's like they're trying to be like semi-gotcha. Like, oh, how would you pay for this? Have you thought about this? I'm sure he did think about it, number one. But number two, the idea that we can't afford universal college or universal health care is honestly stupid, because we spent trillions, with a T, of dollars on the Iraq War, for example. By the year 2053, when you account for the interest, we will have spent $7 trillion in Iraq. $7 trillion. And, you know, nobody's like, oh, well, good googly moogly. Well, gosh, we should have worried about the expenses for that there, sucker, huh? No, people thought, like, no, it's the right thing to do, so we need to do it. Now, they were wrong that you should have cared about the cost there. But why for healthcare? Everybody's like, okay, or education. Okay, now we need to penny pinch. But when it's bombing people, it's like, well, no, go ahead. We'll worry about that later. That's crazy, man. And you can always, always, always cut military spending tremendously, because we spend more than the next 10 biggest countries combined, and most of them are our allies. Cut military spending tremendously and cut corporate welfare. And on that alone, you might not even need to raise taxes, and you can fund universal education or universal healthcare. So those questions are always a little silly, because, you know, it kind of assumes that the U.S. can't do the common sense things that almost all the other modern nations do. Okay. Now let me go to Ben Carson. Maybe this will be our last story of the day. I have some more stuff here from Ben Carson's speech at Liberty University, which happened about a week ago. This is the part where he goes after atheists.
And, you know, I get a lot of grief out there. People say, how can you be a scientist and believe that God created the earth? You know, obviously, you know, we developed from a puddle of promiscuous biochemicals. And if you believe anything other than that, you're a moron. And, you know, I don't criticize them. I say, can you tell me how something came from nothing? And, of course, they can't. They say, well, we don't understand everything. I say, okay, no problem. I say, I'm just going to give you that there's something. Okay. And now you're going to tell me there's a big bang, and it comes into perfect order so that we could predict 70 years hence when a comet is coming, that kind of precision. And they say, well, yeah. And I said, but don't you also believe in entropy, that things move toward a state of disorganization? Well, yeah. So how does that work? And they say, well, we don't understand everything. And I said, I'm not sure you understand anything, but but I say, I'm not going to be critical of you. Not a problem. Because you're entitled to believe what you believe, even though it requires a lot more faith than what I believe. But everybody, believe what you want to believe.
Oh, please. It requires a lot more faith to be an atheist than a fundamentalist Christian, which Ben Carson is. He's a Seventh-day Adventist. He doesn't believe in evolution, and he believes the world was created in 6 days. It takes more faith to be an atheist than a fundamentalist Christian. You do know you would have to account for all the bullshit in the Bible, right? In order for your version of events to be true. Because you believe the Bible's true. So, okay, explain to me how the earth is flat. Explain to me how there was a seven-headed dragon. Explain to me why it's immoral to eat shellfish. Explain to me why it's immoral to wear a mix of two different fabrics. No, your belief obviously requires more faith, because it's not just that he's trying to frame it like he's a deist now, because it's easier for his argument. But in reality, he's a fundamentalist Christian. See, he says at the beginning, how can you be a scientist and believe in God, mocking the people who ask him that? But that's not really what scientists do. There are plenty of scientists who are deists. Most are agnostic or atheist, but there are plenty that are deists. And to be a deist is a respectable position, certainly more respectable than actually believing any particular religion is true, which is theism. And that's my response to that has been, nobody's, you know, on a campaign against deist scientists. We have a problem with is the fundamentalist religious people who are the most ridiculous, who actually believe that their holy books are true. So he tries to frame it like, you know, oh, you guys are the guys that have the explaining to do. No, because the position of atheists is what? The overwhelming majority of atheists are agnostic atheists, which means we say we don't believe in a God. We don't actively believe in one. But do we know if there's a God? Of course not. See, we're humble and we're honest, unlike you. We're objective, where we say there are two different questions here. What do you believe? What do you know? I don't believe in a God. I don't worship Yahweh or the Tooth Fairy. But I don't pretend to know all the deep mysteries of humanity because I'm not a child. You apparently are. He said it takes more faith to be an atheist than it does to be like him. Utter nonsense! Utter nonsense! See, you have beliefs that are empirically false. They've been proven to be false. When we don't know an answer, what we say is, bro, I don't know that one. Again, because we're not children. And finally, let me just say this. He says, well, you know, how can something come from nothing? This is what he asks his non-religious friends. Aha! Gotcha! How can something come from nothing? Gotcha! You know what my response to that is? Hey, Ben, good point. I don't know. How does God come from nothing? God is something. So I flip the question back to you. How does something come from nothing, Ben? Again, I'm consistent on this, which is why I'm an agnostic atheist. I don't believe in a God, but I don't know. So when you ask me a question I don't know the answer to, I'm going to say I don't know. Whereas Ben, he's like, he has the answers, but he's pretending like you're the arrogant one when you're admitting you don't know. Where does God come from? Your belief system fails by your own logic. Because you say, well, you know, you can't have something come from nothing. Okay, well, then you can't have God come from nothing. And this is where they say, well, God exists throughout time. But wait a second. You were just the one that was saying that something can't come from nothing and that, you know, if something's perfectly ordered and complex, there must be a creator. Well, God is more complex and more ordered than us because whoever created us would have to be more intricate and complex and, you know, a grander force. So your belief system fails according to your own logic, which is the most pathetic thing. And when you say, I'm not going to be critical of these people, and then you proceed to the entire time be critical of these people, that shows what kind of a person you are, man, is that you're not able to be objective, and all you do is point the finger at the other people and their beliefs, and you're not able to do that to your own beliefs, and you're totally oblivious to your wanton hypocrisy. All right, guys, I'm out of time. I love you. I'll see you tomorrow. Peace. Mwah.